Catherine, you're coming in a bit in the middle of the story, but it won't be too hard for you to figure out what the plot is, I think. We have been working with the five essential attitudes to be a good devotee. We're up to number four. We introduced number four last week. Darcy had a question. I got a question on the email, but she's not here yet. It was the same question you asked, Saranya, so do you want to ask it again? Remember at the break you asked me, or afterwards? The question had to do with, because I was talking last week about even-minded and cheerful, and quoting Sister Gyanamata saying, we make too much of our feelings and we just run too much with our feelings. So a couple of people asked me the obvious questions that sometimes they're criticized for not being sensitive enough to other people's feelings, or how do you deal with someone whose enthusiasms are totally outside your own enthusiasms? That was what Saranya was asking me. Your enthusiasms are totally outside of what you yourself are drawn to, and yet how do you respond if the other person gets their feelings hurt? Sort of, it's you can see where the question goes. It goes in a lot of different ways. It's an extremely important question because you have to understand it really exactly right, or else we get really, really mixed up. It's interesting that you realize that Master was very tender-hearted, and you see that a lot now in Swami Kriyananda. He's very tender. Just the slightest thing will bring him to tears. You know, the remembrance of Master saying something to him, the remembrance of some spiritual incident, the thought of a friend, sometimes when he talks about his mother, or just childhood in Romania. I mean, it takes very little for his heart to overflow and his eyes to fill up with tears. So when you're looking at that, you're thinking, you know, where is even-minded and cheerful in all of this? When Sister Gyanamata died and Yogananda gave her funeral, he wept over her passing. And he spoke of her as having been fully liberated and what a perfect soul she had been. And he's the self-realized master, and then she's died and he weeps about her dying. So we have these examples, and Swami Kriyananda, I've seen him when he has seen individuals do things that are going to cause grief in their lives. I've seen him weep over that as well. And Swamiji speaks of a time when someone found Master in his room and he was just sobbing. And he was crying because he knew that a certain disciple was going to leave the path and was going to have to suffer a great deal, and Master wanted to help him and he wasn't able to help him. So clearly we're not being asked to become either dry or insensitive. So we must be talking about something else. Swamiji makes he talks a great deal about the importance of feeling, that feeling is the reality, that feeling is essential part of consciousness, and that you can't really have consciousness unless you also have feeling. And he speaks of even something as small as and as simple as a worm. If you poke it in a certain way and it causes it pain, the worm will react. It has a feeling response to the things around it. And among the reasons why Swamiji says you'll never be able to create life just merely by more and more sophisticated computers is because the computer will never have feelings. Because you can't make a machine have feelings. You could make a machine imitate having feelings. You could have it curse when it lost the chess game, but you can't really, the thing doesn't really have, you know, actual feelings in it. Let's see, there was a thought there. Let me see if I can remember what it is. I think my computer has feelings, and and its feelings are of antipathy toward me, and the pleasure it gets in thwarting my plans, but that's an exception to everything else I'm talking about. But at times you do have to really tell yourself that it is an inanimate object and it really doesn't have feelings. But what we're really talking about is the word impersonal, which is a very tricky word. I remember Swamiji used the word impersonal. He would speak of impersonal love when he would talk about how to have a successful marriage. And I was, the only word I can think of is dumb enough to suggest to him once that it wasn't a very good word for him to use, because most people who were into marriages were pretty darn personal about it, and it just didn't really, I didn't think it helped very much. And he listened respectfully without either sneering or laughing, which is a sign of his great nature. He totally ignored me, you know, 5 minutes later started giving a class on marriage and talked about impersonal love. But it took me a long time to figure out what he was talking about. Okay, where the impersonal comes in, and this was also in regard to the question, this is the key to the question. People tend to think that to be impersonal, this is the misunderstanding that sets in, is to be a little bit cold. Well, I'm just going to be impersonal about this. And so, you know, you're upset, but I'm impersonal. So you can be upset and I'll just sort of stand here just ever so slightly aloof and I won't really engage with you. Or, you know, it can go so far as to people who even get married or have children but have this yogic idea in their mind that they're supposed to be impersonal, that they never really fully engage thinking that that's the way they're supposed to be. I remember, of course, I don't think my attitude was really correct either, but very shortly after David and I got married, he had to go on a long trip, and he was gone about 3 weeks. And it seemed like a very long time to me. And toward the end of the time that he was away, one of my friends, this comes under the category of true but irrelevant advice, which is a mistake that devotees make with each other. He said, you know, he sort of asked about David coming back, and I said that I really missed him, and was really looking forward to his coming home. And he sort of said, oh no, be careful, you don't get attached like this. Yeah, I said, if I wasn't attached, do you think I would have married him? I mean, come on. It's like I, you know, did everything to marry this man. It's like, of course I'm attached to him and I miss him. Let's, you know, let's not play games with these things. The individual who was correcting me in that sense had that profound misunderstanding that to be impersonal is to be slightly disengaged. Now, as I was saying, you know, Master and Swamiji were anything but disengaged. I mean, they are so deeply committed to our well-being and so deeply committed to really helping us through every little thing. That letter to the disciples, When I Am Only a Dream, that beautiful poem of Master's, he talks how he will guide us and he will weep through his eyes and perchance also through our eyes, is how he says it, when he sees us straying away from the path. It's a very touching statement. Master says, I will come back a trillion times if necessary, as long as one stray brother is left behind. This is not uninvolved. This is deeply involved. But the impersonal comes in how we see those feelings in the greater context. And that's where the right attitude comes. You know, here I am a father, here I am a wife or a husband, and this is a responsibility I've been given. One dear friend in Ananda, when he got married, is reputed to have said to his wife on their wedding night, no less, now don't misunderstand me. I consider being married a job, and I intend to do a good job. And indeed, he has done a good job. But he had that slightly sort of impersonal attitude about it, which is, this is something that I've been given responsibility for doing, and I intend to do it well. And, you know, I'm going to be very conscientious. I'll follow the rules of Dharma. I'll do everything that I'm supposed to do. But I'm not going to make the mistake of becoming so wrongly identified with this reality that I lose my center in it. And we often make a distinction between feeling and emotion, which is a bit of a semantic definition, but it's clear. Deep feeling is like what Master felt for Sister Gyanamata. Imagine the connection that those two had. I mean, it was when she died, what he heard that. And when Swamiji talked about praying to Master, teach me to love you as you love me. And then Master responded to his thought by looking at him very seriously and saying, how can the little cup hold the whole ocean? But Sister Gyanamata had the whole ocean. So just imagine the sensitivity of that connection. And still, but Master could even weep for her departure, but never lose contact with the whole center of reality. He was responsible for being her friend, and as her friend and her guru and her soul companion in so many different ways, it was appropriate that he would weep. His tender heart was touched. But he never allowed that to blind him to underlying realities. See, what happens to us when we get too involved in our feelings is that we move off of center and we move into an emotion, which is an uncentered feeling, is what you would call it. The opposite of that is, Swamiji said, pure, calm feeling is intuition. That's what an intuition is. It's a pure, calm feeling about something, totally uncorrupted by conflicting cross currents of ego. We just sense completely what's right. We even call it that, the feeling of intuition. So Master could be very sensitively engaged in how other people were feeling. You know, he would sense the thoughts in Swami's mind. He would comfort a disciple. Swamiji tells us a story of when he hadn't seen Master in a few weeks, and he began to miss him very deeply. So I got on the bus and I guess went down to Encinitas, if I have this correctly. And when Master saw him, first thing Master said to Swami was, "I have missed you." And of course, for Swamiji, that was just everything that he was longing to hear. But what Master was really responding to was the extremely sensitive inner nature of Swamiji, who had missed Master. But you see, he didn't in any way say, "Well, I'm always with you. Why are you coming here? You should have stayed in Mount Washington. You could, you know, touch into me just as sensitively there." No, he honored that feeling and responded to it right away. Now, if we really want to be helpful to other people, the one we have to be the most impersonal about is ourself, because it's our own ego we're trying to overcome. And people make the mistake of thinking that I'm going to help you get over your ego by asserting mine. You know, you shouldn't feel this way, and I'm going to teach you how you should feel. But number one, almost always that isn't helpful, because people one has to be very wise before you do something like that. Most people are helped more by being honored and respected. Frontal assaults on the ego are rarely effective, and they're often dangerous for the one doing the assault. I remember Swami Shivani once saying to Swami in the very early years, she was trying to run the garden. She was running it with a lot of very young devotees and very willful devotees who would decide that the tomatoes don't really need to be harvested today. Today is the day when, her favorite line was, "Krishna wants us to go to the river." And you know, in a garden, when it's harvest time, it's harvest time. You don't go to the river. You harvest the tomatoes, or else, and they're not going to be there the next day. So she said to Swamiji, "People may be important than things, but aren't some things more important than people's egos?" Like that. And Swamiji said, "Yes, but before you take action on that, you better be sure you can tell the difference between your ego and theirs, and whether or not what's really happening." So a lot of times people are frivolous. One of the specific questions that was asked to me was, okay, so someone is frivolous and they're all excited about something I'm not excited about, but it's a person who's in the specific situation where there's a close relationship and there's a need to maintain that connection in the right way. And so if one is just simply too aloof, then the other person feels demeaned, you know, and continually demeaned. And you're not accomplishing anything except the slightly superior sense of being able to stay in your own reality. But Master could enter into anybody's reality. He could talk to doctors about medicine. He could talk to actors about theater. He could talk to devotees about devotion. But whatever was required of him, he was able to do. Now that is the key word. See, what we really want is we want to have the freedom to be able to respond in whatever way is appropriate. And so if we're impersonal about ourselves, then it doesn't really matter whether I like this or I don't like this. If it's an appropriate way for me to behave at this point, I can be impersonal enough about myself to be extremely interested in what they're interested in. You know, that's how parents have to treat their children a great deal of time. And a lot of times, we just have to treat our friends that way, or our relatives that way, or our business associates that way. We have to act as if we're very interested, because to do otherwise is to wound them. And we have to have sufficient freedom within ourselves to just go there. But you just remain completely centered in yourself. You're impersonal about it. It's neither an imposition nor anything. It's just, well, this is where the energy needs to flow right now. I mean, I think that Master's whole life was just play acting. I think a great deal of Swami's life is just play acting. But he loves us. So he's not being snooty about it. He's just, well, you know, a child comes over to your house and you're going to have a tea party, and so you set out all the tea things and you have your little pretend tea and you talk about the teddy bears, you know, and what they're doing, and you really enter into it, because that's what's required in order to make the relationship. And, you know, it's a little bit rude perhaps to think of people who are our peers as little children having tea parties, but really sometimes that's how you feel. You have no particular interest in what they're interested in. I'm not just talking about worldly people. I mean, sometimes devotee to devotee, people just have interests that just aren't yours. But it's so winning to be able to genuinely step into someone else's reality. That's not really play acting, because you have the pleasure of entering into their reality and having them respond to you. Isn't it just so magnetic when that happens? I had another thought there. Let me see if I can find it. Well, it seems to have gone away. So does that make sense? It's very important, extremely. Why don't you give to Ekavir the microphone?
It just seems like at times like that, it would become a courtesy. To enter their reality.
Yes.
And it would be rude if you just shined it on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we're here entirely to be of service to others. And I don't mean by that that you actually enter into gross realities. I mean, there are times when the proper response is a little bit distant, when people are trying to draw you into things that you really shouldn't be drawn into, and they shouldn't be trying to draw you into, when people are behaving inappropriately. It's not that you're always cooperative, but there's many times when it's just a question of putting aside your own preferences in order to be supportive of someone else. And it becomes quite delightful. You find that you can just be interested in absolutely everything. We were talking recently about when we all used to live up at Ananda Village, and didn't have cars, and would sometimes come to the Bay Area, and it would be like a four-hour ride, and we'd always have to pile into whoever happened to be able to drive. And you'd oftentimes find yourself in this four-hour car ride with somebody you didn't know very well. And you would, at the end of 4 hours, you would be such good friends. And really, some really lifelong friendships with Ananda people, for me, were formed with people that I had no other connection with, but we drove to San Francisco together. But that's the just entering into the other reality and just, I mean, these of course were devotee friends, but still, you just enter into that reality. And it's not contrary, in fact, it's right down the center. Where that comes in is the fifth attitude, which is serving God in all, you know, by love above all. Okay, any other questions? Yes, Karen?
I would say that I err in the direction of not having easily accessible deep feeling with or for other people, but I have it in other areas, but not necessarily with and around people. And I wonder what kinds of things, Swami, or you might suggest to make it deeper, easier to deepen that inclination.
Well, first of all, one has to also realize that people just have different temperaments, and not every quality is a fault. And depending on your role in life, Swami once said to me something. He said a certain quality about me was not necessarily a fault, but given the position and responsibility I have, it was a fault. But if I didn't have to, you know, relate in a certain way, then it was fine. It was just who I was, and it was okay to be that way. So that's part of it. You don't have to. We're allowed to flow with what we do. I would think that Swamiji's continually telling us about that experience he had where he woke up in the middle of the night in that hotel room and realized that every individual in the world is seeking bliss. And because that of that single reality, they're all lovable because they're all deeply sincere and utterly divine in their inner nature. I had an interesting experience because of writing the book about Swami Kriyananda. And it was a unique experience, but it also told me something, where I got to interview a lot of people and ask them about their experiences with him. And I can type pretty fast. I can type fast enough. So I was able to just put my laptop on my lap and then just look at someone, and they could just talk to me, and I could just type sufficiently to be able to capture their words while they talked to me. So I was able to look right into people's eyes while they spoke. Now, of course, I was talking to devotees, and they were talking about something that was extremely dear to them, so I was definitely seeing people at their best. But it also just taught me something about everybody, that sort of behind whatever facade you see is exactly what Swami's talking about, is that, you know, that deep sense of looking for divine experience and occasionally finding divine experience. And when you see people in that vibration, it's not even that you love them, it's that you become, your realities merge, because you're both then out of personality into the superconscious self. So I think the only real way to really love people is to move out of personality, because many people's personalities are not pleasant. You know, let's face it, they just aren't. They either are not skilled, or there are many things about them. But everybody's divinity is thrilling. So I find it fun to practice. I practice with store clerks, and I sometimes practice with homeless people, or I practice with just unpleasant individuals. I've described to you the time that I was trapped in conversation with a 6.5-foot Croatian whose sense of personal space was about 2 inches, and who was very loud and very talkative. He pretty much, I'm not still standing there talking to him, so he must have stopped at some point. But as Swamiji said, his sense of timing embraced infinity. But it was a kind of a critical moment for me, because love was the last thing that was on my mind at that point. There were many, many other qualities that were rushing through me as he leaned over me and talked to me in a really loud voice about things I wasn't at all interested in. But it was sort of like, so what? You know, that's where you just become very impersonal. So what? So everything about this is everything I dislike, including the fact that I will probably have to be here for the rest of my life, and then I'll have to get my neck fixed afterwards. Everything was awful. But I just sort of just tried to just realize that somewhere in all of that noise and unpleasantness was somebody whose essential consciousness was just the same as mine. And when I say just the same as mine, you know how hurt we get when people don't love and respect us? You know, and how outraged we get when people don't treat us properly? Because we all know ourselves, and we want everybody else to know us. And I just realized he must feel just the same somewhere in that gigantic body and in all that noise. And you just kind of just find that and rest there. Rest in the heart. I've also found it extremely helpful to meditate on people. Just try to, when you're not with them, when you're just in meditation, just try to find people. Just find them out there in the infinite. And try to feel that when everything settles down, deep in their heart, they're just like you. And then that helps, because then when all the rest of it roils around and all your impatience, my impatience, I won't put anything on you, my impatience, my preferences, it's like, why? And that this is actually the fifth attitude. This is what I'm really talking about, is serving the divine in all. What is it to serve the divine? I mean, how is it ultimately that we serve the divine? We serve the divine by relating to it, by awakening it, by respecting it. What do we love so much about being with highly advanced souls? What we really love is because of the way they see us. And what you see when you're with Swamiji or someone of his caliber or any advanced person, they look at you and they see something else. And that strongly projected belief in that aspect of your nature awakens it within you. It's just there's so much faith and it just, I mean, the powerful mind is looking at you and just seeing self-realization soon enough. And as Swamiji said, the way he even feels when he sees people who are suffering is instead of seeing their suffering, he sees, oh, then how much more joyful they will be when they realize God and that suffering ends. That to me was one of the sweetest things, because we tend to think of the suffering and he sees it as just making the divine romance all the sweeter. Because look what they will be rescued from. And just even that thought, turning everything in a positive direction, you feel it. People's thoughts are very powerful. When I, before I was married to David, I had a young, short marriage, and my husband was extremely critical of me mentally. Let me put it differently. He was a perfectionist, and I didn't quite live up to his perfection. He was a nice man and he loved me, but he had a very controlling attitude about lots of things. And just it was just so strong. Well, among the many reasons why we ceased to be married was it was just that thought form all the time that I wasn't quite measuring up in one way or another. That poor David, when we were first married, poor man. It's, you know, when you get a second marriage, it takes a little while to figure out who's who in there. Now it's been enough years, but David also has a very particular nature, and he has a great mastery over the physical plane. And the physical plane just obeys him. It doesn't obey me, no matter how sincerely I try to fold my sweaters. I look at them like a couple of weeks later, and they're not folded again. You know, they're just kind of piled up. His are always folded. He can always fold them, and they remain folded. Mine, I think, in the night, sort of, you know. But we lived in this little A-frame house at Ananda Village, and we had a wood stove, and it was summer, and we used to get the newspapers every once in a while, but we would save the newspapers for the winter fire. And we had a cardboard box, and it was under the stairs, and sometimes you'd go out of the house and you'd put the paper into the box. And I walked out, and I took the newspaper, and I put it sort of in the box. It was mostly in the box. Just part of it was hanging over the edge of the box. You know, of course, once you start that, then the box falls to pieces, but it was mostly in the box. I put it in the box, and he didn't say a word, poor man. He was just walking down the stairs. But he looked over, and I heard him. I heard his mind, essentially like seeing a lifetime of this. And I was so mad. Don't do that to me, I said. He said, what? You know? I said, it's in the box. Because I just couldn't face it again, you know. And he hasn't done it to me again, thank God. But you know, just that much. How much of that we're dealing with that all the time? Just a little bit of, well, that doesn't really look very good on her, you know. Gee, he's gotten kind of fat, hasn't he? You know, she's aged so much. What an awful hair dye job. You know, just like all these things that just cross your mind, isn't it? And much worse. But you think that those things don't reach people? They reach them all the time. It's one of the reasons why everybody's so nervous. It's because there's all this energy. And just imagine being a force that moves through the world that thinks, oh, look, there's Divine Mother. Oh, look, bliss incarnate. Oh, look at that beautiful sincerity. Oh, look how dear this person is. And you either literally find qualities to enjoy, or you just ignore all qualities and go behind it, one or the other. Swamiji says that when he walks around, now he has the oddest sensation almost everywhere he is, that everybody he sees is an old friend. You know, he'll walk into a restaurant, he says a theater, or he'll just feel like he's among old friends. And just that quality of reaching out, which you don't even have to talk to people, you just feel it inside yourself. You just literally then, your mere presence in the world becomes a blessing. And that's the fifth attitude, is that you're serving God in all. I haven't really quite finished the fourth attitude, but we're skipping a little bit here. But it's like it's not enough merely to hold these attitudes within ourselves. We also have to practice them. We have to become skilled at them. We have to become radiating stations of divine consciousness. In the book, Art is a Hidden Message, Swamiji's book, which is a very, very interesting book. He talks in there about creativity. You sort of feel after you read that book that being a creative artist is an essential step on the spiritual path. And in fact, it really is. But in the way of Ananda Sanghis, which is the seven points that define what Ananda's about, we strive to make our lives works of art. And then he says that whether it's music or painting or so on, or just your life itself, you make your life a work of art. And art as a hidden message is that all artistic endeavor conveys some state of consciousness. And so what state of consciousness are we going to walk around conveying? And one of the factors, it works both ways. It's like we think, well, I have to keep my consciousness on God. But who do we think God is? Where do we think God is? There's that marvelously touching passage in the Bible where Jesus says, you know, I was a hungered and you fed me. I was imprisoned and you visited me. I was in grief and you comforted me. And the disciples said, Lord, when did we do this? You know, we don't really remember doing all those things. And he said, well, when you did it to the least least among you, you were doing it to me. And that's how Mother Teresa of Calcutta formed her whole ministry. And when she was being interviewed, they were filming her out on the street, and she was picking up these just horrible maggot-infested dying beggars. And I mean, it's not pretty when you see that kind of poverty and that kind of suffering. And just pick them up and carry them. And it would be like, I think that someone asked her essentially, how can you do this? Like, how can you stand it? You're a refined person. How can you bring close to your own person such a gross energy? She said to me, he's Jesus. I'm not doing this to a beggar. And the other side of it, which was very interesting, we met Mother Teresa several times because we would take our pilgrimage trips to India. And we would go to the mother house of her order in Calcutta. And she was very orderly, matter-of-fact person. And if you came to 5:30 Mass, at 6:30 afterwards, she would meet with foreign groups. And she got to know us because we had the intelligence to sing for her. The first time we were there, we thought, how do we communicate instantly who we are? So we sang a few songs from the oratorio. So she knew us and she really liked us. But she was so impersonal. She was really one of the most impersonal people I think I've ever met. She was all business. She had heart, but she was all business. Everybody was Jesus to her. It was pretty much just the same. You know? So she was loving, but she was kind. But it was interesting because she wasn't sentimental. There was no sort of aura around her. She was just very straightforward, but you could see that she held her consciousness pretty much in the same place all the time. And that place was just, I'm here to do whatever Jesus wants me to do, and so I'm going to do this. And then I'll do this, and then I'll do this. She was just very even-minded about all of it, and she was cheerful. She really taught her nuns to smile. And that was her smile was a really big part of her ministry, kindly. But you could just feel this completely open, but nonetheless rather impersonal heart. It was a very interesting saint in that respect. It was interesting. I liked being with her, but when I went there after she died and meditated next to where her body was buried, I felt much more than I'd ever felt from her when she was living. So whether that was just me or her, I don't know which, but I was very surprised sitting next to that Mahasamadhi Mandir, I would call it, although I don't know if she was liberated, I don't think she was, but her shrine, you know, they buried her in the Indian fashion there. Very powerful. Sitting next to the body was really, sitting next to her uninhabited body was more powerful to me than having sat next to her actual body. Who knows? Maybe she received a great grace when she died, or maybe I was just in a better mood. But what one always thinks about, you know, people like her set a standard for people like us and give us something to aspire to. Does that help? Okay. Any other questions before we go on from this? Swamiji's talking, I wanted to go back to living for God alone because it's, I was really meditating on what that means. The way Swamiji talks about this, let me just stop for a moment. I had just a thought the other day thinking about this. Swami was less than 25 years old when he wrote this course. I mean, he just had been with Master such a short time. I think Master was gone already. I'm not really sure when he wrote it, but he was such a young man, so new on the path. And just look at the magnitude of his understanding. But Master had him out there reading the whole Gita commentary and helping edit the Gita commentary. And Swami tells us how much Master just poured his thoughts into him. But you can also see how much he was born with to be able to pull all this together at such a young age. It's so new himself. When we think about living for God alone, what Swami's really trying to get us to understand is that, well, the way he puts it is, if one does not live for God alone, mundane matters assume importance. That's the way he put it. And the devotee may go through some serious ordeals because of it. So that phrase sort of helped tip me into what he really means by living for God alone, because we've talked about the fact in the lives that we have a lot going on. Swamiji on Sunday made, in the live telecast from Los Angeles, he made a very interesting statement when he just said he has no sense of himself anymore. It's a flow of energy. He can't find himself in that flow of energy anymore. He's been saying this for some time. That was especially, he said it really happened in June of a year and a half ago when he went through that cycle where he came so close to dying and then was brought healed just in an instant. He said since then, he just has no sense of himself. What was the exact phrase he used? I can't remember.
He said it was a phenomenon.
A phenomenon. Just a phenomenon that was happening. It didn't mean that he was phenomenal. It just meant that there's no ego identified with it. It's just happening without any sense of self. It's a very interesting idea to contemplate. But in this context of living for God alone, it's like to live for God alone says all of these other things happen. You know, I have these things I'm responsible for, because in the same breath that he's telling us that he has no sense of self, he tells us that he's writing, he's taking the 26 lessons on material success and reducing them to 6 lessons, and he's going to give this course and he hopes it'll be very helpful. I mean, there's a lot of things he's doing, but they're a flow of energy and they're not tied back to the ego self. You know, all of us are, when you have an ego, everything that happens, you relate to it. This has to do with me. I'm doing well at work. I'm doing badly at work. I have this ambition. I want this to happen. Even the thought, I want to realize God. I want to advance spiritually. There's always this sort of moving force, which is the I, which is what gives us karma. Because when things happen, we identify with them, and the sense of ego ties them to us, and they make an impression on the chakras. When there's no sense of ego, there's no karma anymore. You can't make any karma because there's no I doing it, so there's nothing to identify with. Now, when we want to, coming back to this, when we're trying to live for God alone, what it means is that the only thing that really matters in every circumstance is how I am relating to the divine in the midst of it. In other words, am I relating to the divine in the midst of it? You know, am I really using this opportunity to overcome my ego and to become closer to God, or am I not? And so often we think, will I succeed? Will I fail? Will people like me or not? Will I get fired? Will I get hired? You know, will so-and-so love me? Will this person be mad at me? Is this going to work out the way I want it? You know, how am I going to get all this work done? We just have all of these other considerations that move us off of that single thought, that the only thing that matters is my relationship to God. I respect Hari Das for many, many reasons, and he's always very instructive because he's so definite in the way he goes at things. And I observed something in being in meetings with Hari Das, whom many of you know because he lived here, but anyway, he's a devotee at Ananda, that sometimes we'd be in a meeting and maybe the conversation would turn a little critical. Maybe some person was, we had to talk about someone and what they were or weren't doing or something like that, or a situation that was creating a little bit of angst. I mean, I had to figure this out for a while, but what I first experienced was that we'd just be going along in a certain way in the conversation, and then Hari Das would hijack the meeting, and he would just hijack it verbally, and he would sort of take us somewhere else. And where he would be taking us would be always to some sort of positive orientation, maybe specifically related to the event, maybe not. And when I began to sort of wonder what was going on, I observed that Hari Das was always primarily paying attention to his consciousness. And if something would happen in the meeting that would cause his consciousness perhaps to slip a little bit into judgment or a little bit into worry, he would consider that an emergency of enormous proportions. And so he would hijack the meeting and verbalize some reality until he could get his consciousness back right. And then as soon as his consciousness was right, he would give us back the meeting. So on one level, it was nutty and annoying, but when I really got what was happening, it was just absolutely fabulous. And because we're living for God alone. And if in the process of accomplishing anything, we allow our consciousness to slip, we have then lost everything. And so it's so easy to get sucked into all kinds of things. You know, explaining your point of view, getting others to agree with you. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't do those things, because we have to act in this world. We are a phenomenon. We are happening. We are, as Swamiji said earlier, before he was saying this, he called Kriyananda an event for which he was responsible. You know, we are events for which we are responsible, and often, you know, the individual event is responsible for other events, and we have to use our will in the world. And again, I'll go back to both Swami and Master as examples. They had enormous will, and they used that will in the world. So it's not about becoming either weak, passive, or uncreative. But it's always understanding that consciousness is the only thing that matters. We live for God alone. And so we don't sweat the small stuff. Mundane matters don't bother us. In the New Age Renunciate Order and in the book Sadhu Beware, Swamiji has all these rules for how to overcome your ego, all these guidelines for overcoming your ego, and they're very annoying. You know, allow yourself to be misunderstood, let yourself be blamed for things you didn't do. When people are wrong, you know, about you, don't correct them. Because all that does is just, oh, look at me, I'm right. You know, I'm misunderstood, you must understand me. Swamiji himself has this attitude of, I'm not here, I'm here to overcome my ego, not to defend it. And it was very difficult when we were in the midst of lawsuits in which defending yourself is the entire key. He's a great man, but he was a horrible witness. Just horrible. You know, no matter what the question, he would just give the most minimal answer. And once, after a whole day of questioning, he told us that the battery in his hearing aid had gone out early on. And, you know, but he just, like, he wouldn't have defended, he wouldn't have even defended the lawsuits, except that a lot of us were involved, and he didn't feel it would be fair. But it's not an affectation. It's that, who cares? I live for God alone, and I'm not going to struggle in this world to make people understand me. Why would I want that? And he says in here too, he says, don't look, he says, justice on the spiritual path, don't look for it. Mm-hmm. And that's the same thing. And he said, Master, I mean, this is the guru was able to do this. Master would often blame them for things that they didn't do. And sometimes he would excoriate them for things that they didn't do, just to see how they would respond. Because consciousness was the only thing that mattered. I've watched Swamiji in meetings. It's been most interesting. Sometimes when there was one particular thing that happened many years ago. There was a huge misunderstanding among many people. And I watched Swamiji, and I'm very observant, and I pay attention to the words. And I wasn't involved. I was a close-in person, but I was a spectator. So I didn't have any emotion. I was just able to watch the interplay. And I watched Swami sort of when he finally had to resolve the situation. He kind of touched everybody just a little. And then one person, he laid the whole blame on them. And that person really didn't deserve the whole blame. In fact, earlier, Swamiji had said things that exonerated that person virtually completely and said that he thought everybody else's point of view was just pretty wrong. And then he just put all the responsibility right here. And fortunately, you know, the guy was, like, interested rather than upset. Well, how very interesting. You know, if this is what he chooses to do, this is what he chooses to do. Once Swamiji scolded David and me both for quite fiercely. I mean, quite strongly. I don't want to exaggerate, but he was very strong. And he was scolding us for doing something that we hadn't done at all. And he had all the facts wrong. Everything about the situation was totally confused. But he was so intent on scolding us, it really didn't seem like the time to tell him. So we just, you know, yes, sir, no, sir, of course, absolutely, and we just went with it. And then because the situation itself needed to be straightened out, a few days later, after all that had died away, we said, you know, sir, it didn't really happen that way at all. Oh, I know, he said, just like that. But his response was even more interesting. If people could even accuse you of that, then you have a problem that you need to overcome. Wow, isn't that interesting? You know, he's just, and oftentimes, I mean, this was Swami directly, and that was very interesting. And we'd had the sense to realize that. He writes that here. If you're being scolded unfairly, just think of all the times you got away with it without getting caught. Especially when you think of past lives, even if you can't, don't just think of it in this life. This is completely peripheral, but Parvati once was, let's see. She was with her parents at some point, and they went out to play miniature golf. I mean, this is after she'd come to Ananda. They're playing miniature golf. And she said, oh, this is fun. I've never done this before. And then her mother looks at her, And she remembers that in high school, that was where she always said she was going. She sort of mutters something like, for a long time. So we get away with a lot. And sooner or later, it's going to catch up with us. And if we just can live for God alone, God understands. He knows. And you're never wrong. You're never misunderstood by the divine, because the divine is in your own heart. And as long as you're right with God, everything is right. And that is the only value there is. And of course, where there is Dharma, there is victory, because when you have that kind of consciousness, then the energy that you're putting out is also very magnetic. And, you know, it depends on your karma whether things will work out or not. But things do have a way of working out if, instead of using situations to create more dissonance, we use those situations to create more harmony. And, if somebody's extremely unfair to you, that always means that they're in trouble in some way or another. If they're using you as a scapegoat, as a whipping boy, as a self-justifying issue, that means they're in a lot of trouble, because they wouldn't be doing those things if they weren't in trouble. So that's where we come into, the other attitude, which is we're serving God in all. So rather than using it as an opportunity to strike back, very often we just want to use that as an opportunity to be ever more relaxed and loving, because that's what the situation really requires of us in the time. Okay, any questions about this? Because otherwise I'll take a short break. Okay, we're taking our break a little earlier tonight, so let's take a short break. And reminded in the break by someone who did their homework that I forgot to ask if anybody did their homework. So I'm going to pretend that I don't know. Did anyone do their homework? Pass the microphone over. So it won't be just a big blank on the recording. Okay.
Well, no, because one of the things I always try to do at my job is, even-minded and cheerful, even before you were reminding us of that important step on the path. And I realized that, I kind of almost have to engage in the positive thinking at all times to get back to that sometimes.
Right.
Because you encounter something like yesterday I was, reminded that my numbers have not been so good right now, and I'm kind of, sinking down a little bit in terms of the comparisons where I am with everyone else, and I'm fine, but compared to everyone else, it's kind of getting lower, and I realize that, okay, well, I'm here now. Uh-huh. All I can do is go forward from here, and really my attitude is entirely up to me right now. I can sulk over it and everything, and so that positive thinking brought me back to the even-minded, and, then it was a lot easier, but...
Very good.
Just sort of... I wrote it on a little note next to my desk, too, so I look at it every day, and...
Very good.
Definitely very helpful.
But. Yeah, it's interesting how they interplay with each other. That's the fun, too. Yeah, of course, if you're positive, then it's easier to be even-minded. If you're thinking about God alone, then it's easier to be positive. Yeah.
But it's hard to be, it's hard to be even-minded and cheerful when something comes at you, and you're like, how in the world can I be cheerful about that, or even-minded? And then you have to remember, okay, if I think about it in this way,
right,
it's very easy to be even-minded and cheerful again.
Right, and if you're impersonal, this is the point where the hero collapses on his desk in despair. One of my friends likes to talk in picture captions. I think that's very helpful. And so sometimes you're just going through your life and you start describing, you write a picture caption. There is Adam weeping at his desk. And then you're just sort of you're just a little impersonal. It's just a photograph of Adam weeping at his desk. It's very good. I write the chapter summary. This is the chapter in which the hero, stumbles and falls. This is the chapter in which the hero believes that all is lost. And all of those just impersonalize it a little bit, and you twist it a little bit. Yeah, very good. So anyone else who wants to make a report? Okay, Sharmila.
So even-minded and cheerful is the good one for me, too. I've been... having a lot of time sharing my very small apartment with two young adults and a 9.5-month-old baby, and find that food goes right out of the house almost as fast as it comes in, and garbage piles up a lot more than it did with one person. And so I've been really trying just to practice even-minded and cheerful and impersonal, also just being an observer. and just kind of noticing, oh, isn't that interesting? Oh, that's fun. Well, I guess I should do that. Yeah, that would be a good idea, rather than why didn't they do it?
Right.
Or, you know, it would be nice if they would just realize that.
Justice on the spiritual path. Don't look for it. But I mean, these are very small examples, but you see, if you get these attitudes together in your mind, courage, positive thinking at all times, even-minded and cheerful, living for God alone, serving the divine and others, you see, every time you hit a bump, if you turn yourself in this direction, and if you we become totally habituated to doing this, that you see what a huge, I mean, just an absolutely life-changing difference it will make. Just such simple things. It'll just keep us out of the chasms of spiritual darkness and threat to our vocation. It's a big thing.
One other thing I wanted to say, sort of a question that comes up for me about this that's happened with a couple of my friends, is that sometimes they act as if I'm unreal because I'm so cheerful and positive. And it's a little disconcerting, and sometimes I'm not feeling any great surges of emotion one way or another. It's just like it's interesting, and you know, they're going through difficult times, and you know, well, I mean, it's part of what we were talking about earlier. But then just, you know, being positive is not something that most people are a lot.
That's why we have community. Yeah. Because you know, being on this path separates you from a lot of people. There's just a point at which you just can't go there. You do have to be real. You can't just be pretending. But there's a great difference between consciously knowing what the dangers are and countering it with dynamic positive will. That's quite different than denial. And, you know, many people just don't believe in the positive outcome of life, period. And so anything that emphasizes the positive outcome of life is naive. I mean, this is a terrible age in which we live. So sometimes we just have to be silent. And, you know, sometimes you just have to say some slight self-deprecating remark. Well, I know what it is, my favorite. This is Sri Yukteswar's. He says the best way to settle arguments is you say, well, perhaps you're right. And you haven't conceded a thing, but you've also sort of ended it. Well, perhaps you're right. I'll reflect on that. But then you just leave it, because now they've had the satisfaction of having you offer a concession, but you've really conceded nothing. The other thing that, this is slightly different, but I've noticed over the years that Swamiji was the master of what I would call, he would make a little noise that was kind of like, yeah. And I sort of ended up calling it sympathetic clucking noises. And I realized that because I'm such a verbal person and I have a verbal response for just about everything that happens, and I mean, as I said to people, it's not really that I know that much, it's just that I can articulate every scrap of information that's in my mind. So I always have a verbal response, and it took me a long time to realize that a lot of times don't give it. So somebody says something to you, but the answer is not going to serve anybody. It's just going to serve the cause of showing that you can articulate an answer, and then the whole thing is just going to escalate. So sometimes you just go, And, you know, in India they have this, they shake their heads like that, and sometimes they say, acha, acha. Which when I asked Swami what that meant, he says, it means I exist, you exist. And sometimes it's just the best thing to say, well, yes, I exist, you exist, there we are, you know. And it's surprising how often people feel like the conversation has been settled and really nothing has happened. It's just that there's been a kind of consciousness relationship there, and your heart is open, and there you are. You just don't have to settle it. I learned that actually really dynamically when Karen Levin, who was about to come in and marry Danny Levin, who was an American, she was an Italian. She had been coming in and out of the country for 12 years, coming in on tourist visas, overstaying her tourist visa for, you know, by months or years, going back out, coming back in. This was the last time she was going to come in illegally, because the next time she would be married to an American citizen. And this was the time when they tried to capture her. So the word came out at the airport that Karen is down in the immigration and she can't get out of the immigration place because somehow, I think it was something really dumb, like her fake return ticket she'd actually bought it for earlier than her arrival. It was just, like, you know, just like, you know, and they noticed, somebody noticed. This was before all the 9/11, so it wasn't nearly as tough. So Swami just goes downstairs, and he just says, "Well, hello, so seems like you have a friend of mine here. You know, I've lived in Italy for quite a long time. I have many Italian friends. You know, and this woman, she's such a good cook. You know, have you ever had Italian food? Italian food is so wonderful. Just one non sequitur after another, totally unrelated to anything. But with all this exuberance and all this enthusiasm, sometimes people mistake me for Italians. You know, when I go to Rome, they think I'm from Geneva." And it's finally the man just stamped her passport. And it was just, he just, I don't know what he did. He created some, but a lot of times you just play the energy. You just play the energy. You don't have to play the facts as much. And because sometimes the facts are not real positive. You just play the energy. And it's a good thing to remember, God alone, serving God in all. Now, your homework. Were you going to say something, Lahari? No, okay. You just raised your hand. You were proud of yourself. Okay.
I leave my homework.
Anyone else?
I leave it for anyone else.
Anyone else who has anything to say? Okay, very good. All right, now, your question was, oh, we were talking about, Sarah was talking about the fact of being in a situation where, about anger, and needing to respond. She's in a childcare situation, and sometimes when you have children, you have to respond strongly. You can't always just say, "All right, little Johnny, just keep having your tantrum, and I'll still give you your dinner." No, no, little Johnny, don't bite your sister like that, you know. Sometimes strong energy is needed. But, I mean, we didn't talk specifically about anger, but anger is a very interesting one. Remember the stories that Swami tells about Master? That particular one where he was really scolding that nun, and he would turn toward her and be so fierce and then turn back, and there was a man sitting on the other side, and he would smile and wink, and then he would turn around and go back. Now, it was simply an awareness of what was required and a fearlessness about doing what's required. And this comes under the idea of serving the divine in all. I remember I had to spend a period of time when I was around 18, and 18 and 19, and I realized that my accommodating nature was not really harmonious. It was fearful. And we were talking earlier in some context here about what we're really trying to be is free. And so compulsion is not the same as having a clear consciousness. I was harmonious and therefore appeared to be sort of in an elevated state, but what I was actually was terrified of conflict. So I was compelled, I was acting compulsively, it just happened to be compulsively nice. It wasn't compulsively, you know, mean, but it was still compulsion, and it was not the same as freedom. And when that realization came to me, I was spending the summer in New York City, an ideal place to learn to be mean, because nobody notices, you know. I mean, just everybody was so, especially compared to mellow Californians, people were just so tough, you know, that just their whole manner of speaking with each other. I remember a woman once complained about this man, you know, he's just so this way, and Swami just said so sweetly, "He's from New York." You know, it's like, it's just who he is. So I was in New York, so I got to practice standing up for myself and, you know, speaking out when I needed to speak out, and it just would roll off everyone's back. It was a great way to learn. And I kept at it until I began to enjoy it. And then I realized I'd gone far enough. And it was a longer learning curve than just that, but that was the start of it. But not too many years later, just a few years later, I was working at Ananda on a very challenging project. We were publishing Swami's book, The Autobiography. And there was a very feisty Scorpio person on that team, a woman, good friend of mine, very feisty Scorpio, whose whole family just was the opposite of mine. I mean, she told me that no dinner ever ended without at least one person screaming and stomping out of the room. It was just the way they all related. You know, they slammed doors, they yelled, and so she was very comfortable with that energy. And we were all under a lot of stress. And she just started arguing with me. And we were actually in the Hansa, what is the Hansa temple now. And at that time, there was an open staircase from the basement to the top. Now it's closed. I was on the top and she was at the bottom. And we were in the middle of this building and all the other employees, this is Ananda, people don't do this. She just started getting very wound up. And I'm sort of just looking at her, and I just realized this woman needs to fight with somebody. She just really needs to fight. And so I thought, well, it might as well be me. And it was most interesting to me because in a very impersonal way, she started saying rude and insulting things, so I insulted her. She started talking louder. I started talking louder. She started telling me what a complete jerk I was, her boss, what a complete idiot of a boss I was, and I told her what a worthless employee she was. And everybody in the office is just like, you know, because we're just yelling at each other, right? These things don't happen in our community. And then we sort of crested, and then because we really love each other, and we just sort of came down like that, and then she was fine. And it was so interesting to me, and I sort of thought back. I was so proud of myself, really, because God needed somebody who could have a fight with her. And I was never in it. I was never as... I'll tell another Haridas story, which is a famous Haridas story with his wife, remember? Mm-hmm. He and his wife, she's Irish, they sometimes have gone at it. And once they were beginning to be annoyed with each other about something, he smiled at her and he said, "I'm not caught yet, are you?" But it's, you know, I was never caught. But I saw what was needed, and I just gave what was needed. It was a peculiar kind of service, but it really was what was needed. You know, because it just kind of kept her in the ring. It was a little bit like sympathetic clucking noises. She just needed to be able to be angry and upset and annoyed. And if I hadn't fought with her, if I had been, now, it's not really appropriate for you to be yelling like that in the middle of this community. Be gentle, be kind. You know, she might have really stomped out and never come back. You know, she just had to be accepted in that reality, in that moment. And that was when I realized the difference between actually being free and being compulsive, because I wasn't afraid of that kind of energy anymore. And so when God needed somebody to do that, I just did it. I mean, I know I have limits, but it was very interesting for me. And I also realized that, you see, if we're really trying to serve the divine in all, we need to be able to serve in whatever way is needed. We can't just have these narrow parameters. I can just do these little tiny things. We have to really be able to intuitively know what people need and then just be there with them. I complained to Swamiji once about this person that I found extremely overbearing. It was very difficult to get along. Swami said, "Oh, when I'm with that person, I just don't bother to have a personality," was how he put it. He said, "Because they just have so much personality, there's really no room for anyone else, so I just don't bother to have one." It's really quite fun. You watch how often you just want to assert yourself. But do we, you know, is it really necessary? Are you even serving yourself in such a moment? You know, and here's another thought which is important in this. Serving the divine in all also includes yourself. Swamiji actually spoke to us once as colony leaders, community leaders of Ananda, to a group of us once. Very seriously, he said, "You can't afford... in any situation," he said, "you can't afford not to consider your own spiritual welfare also." And the way he put it was, he said, for example, he said, if a certain decision, uncharitable decision, needs to be made, sometimes you have to be uncharitable because it's required, but being uncharitable would be unwholesome for you spiritually, he said, just make another decision. That the divine you also have to serve is yourself. And just trust that where there is Dharma, there is victory. He said it's presumptuous not to consider your own well-being in the situation. It's very, very interesting. Do you understand that? It's a very interesting statement, and I've remembered it many times because there have been circumstances when people have come to me and said, "This is happening and that's happening, and you have to do something. And this is happening and that's happening. It would be nice to do something, but I can't do it. Because if I were to do it, it would be bad for me." And so, you know, sometimes you can't always explain that to people, but, you know, I just finesse it in some way or another. I just can't do it because it would bring the wrong consciousness out of me to do that.
If God really needed to fix the situation, I'm sure he could find a way to do it.
Yeah.
Your soul.
Well, that's the other way of saying, yes, if God really wanted it fixed, he can do it in another way. It's not Dharma. You know, and that's, I mean, living for God alone, serving the divine and others, includes you. And you have to be impersonal enough about yourself to value yourself. That's what I was trying to say about being impersonal, is that you're just as valuable as anybody else. And if you can genuinely be self-sacrificing in such a way that it's really a sincere and a healthy gesture, that's one thing. But that's why sometimes when people are too self-sacrificing, it doesn't really work, and you know it's not working, because they're not really being impersonal about themselves. They have so little respect for themselves that they don't value themselves appropriately. This came up in a group dynamic in one of our communities at one point. There was one person who is very egoless and very self-sacrificing, but had limits, but didn't have the capacity to ever declare their own limits. So when tasks were being divided up in a sort of communal situation, this person would often volunteer for things that when it finally came to do, they just didn't have the capacity to carry out as much as they volunteered for. But the person would never declare their limits. And as a result, actually, it torqued the whole the group dynamic, because that person was always taking responsibilities they couldn't fulfill. Everybody knew that they couldn't fulfill it, but it was never able to say, look, I can do this much, but not that much. And then what happens is, if everybody just puts their true self out, then we all sort of figure out how it's going to work. And if nobody can cover it, then we come up with another plan. But everybody gets to see impersonally who we are. And it's a very, very important part of, well, group dynamic, but a part of personal health. Because if you're torqued in any direction, you see, humility, Master describes, is self-honesty. And your self-honesty is, I can certainly manage that because I'm very capable. Or, I'd like to do that, but you know, when it comes down to it, I just know I'm not going to. Because I'm just not going to, because I don't like it, I won't. You know, on many occasions I've had to say things like that. Just, these are hard ones, lessons for me, so I work them out. I'm just not going to do it. I mean, when I married David, I told him I'd never vacuum, and I've been pretty close to solid on that one. You know, it's just like, I just won't do it. And I promise you, I'll never wash out the bathtub. And I think I really have held that one. Absolutely. I love you. You're a wonderful person. But I'm never going to clean the bathtub because I hate cleaning bathtubs, period. There's like nothing, really. No amount of love is going to get me to clean that bathroom. It's just, but that's who you are. And then everybody works with it. I'll get a part-time job to pay somebody to do it, you know. So it's a silly thing, but you see the point. Because you're impersonal. You don't have to be perfect in all areas. This is just who we are. That's serving the divine in all. That includes me. And again, what I was saying is, it serves the divine to be honest. It doesn't serve the divine to be pretending. And this is a very fine line, because this is what we were talking about, being positive without being insincere. Sincerity is really the key. You have to really mean everything that you say. Swami talks a lot about sincerity. So, okay, let me see what else there might be before we... He says here that the word chela means to serve, which I never knew before. Chela, I always thought, meant child. But it also means to serve. Chela means disciple. It's one of the dearest words for disciple. That's why we call the house we live in Chela Bhavan. It's the house of the disciples. That was in lieu of calling it the Praver house. Or even worse, the big house. We fined people whenever they called it the big house. Okay. So, well, there's a little bit more to say, but it's a little too late. I think I'm sort of done for tonight, unless there's any other questions. Any questions or thoughts? There's some really juicy stuff, but I don't want to start it now. Yes, sir?
I guess almost answered it, but maybe if you could talk a little bit more about the difference between intuitive feeling and emotion,
okay.
More in the sense of where does it cross that line?
Where does it cross the line?
You know what I mean? In terms of if an event happens, you know, you can obviously feel negatively about it in a certain way from an impersonal standpoint, but, you know, how is it the... I guess how can you
No,
tell?
It's a good question. I mean, like the Giants won the World Series. Are we allowed to rejoice? You know, can we be happy that we won? Yes, we can be happy. I decided to deeply identify with the Giants. It just seemed like it would be worth doing. a feeling leaves you firmly rooted. You know, like the Giants won, but they won. Isn't that great? You know, this is peps up the area. They did this great thing. There'll be a big parade. Maybe it'll improve the economy. Everybody's morale will be better. That would be just a feeling about it, and it's a fun feeling. We're just joking with it. An emotion would be when you sort of step out. If you're imagining a tree, when you have a feeling, you're standing in the trunk of the tree, and maybe you're reaching way out because you have great branches, and you're way all the way out here. That's where I am when I say the Giants won. I am so far from where I actually live, but I'm reaching out to it without losing connection. So even though I'm enjoying this little kind of end of the branch, little game out here that the Giants won, I've never actually taken the center of my happiness into whether or not the Giants have won. It's such a ridiculous example. It's a really good example. But whether or not the latest 40-pound box of blue rayon twill came back streaked or not when I sent it to the dye company, that was a little more of a challenge. It was pretty far out there in terms of my center, but you know, okay, it came out streaked. I have 100 yards of unusable fabric. You know, what am I going to do with it? It's pretty, but it's still pretty far out from my center. But the challenge to not wake up in the middle of the night and think, what am I going to do with that 100 yards of fabric, is a little greater than whether or not the Giants win. But still, I could just say, Asha, it's nothing but cloth and money. You know, and cloth and money are a problem, and 40 pounds is a big box. But it's just cloth and money, and so you sort of come back from the edge of it all the way to here. And so you can perceive things exactly as they are. My, this is going to be a really difficult situation to deal with because these people really hate me and they're really out to get me. And there's nothing much that I seem to be able to do about it. But you can move all the way out to the end of that branch and then your whole life becomes centered around whether these people hate you. Have you transferred the center of your reality into that idea, or are you relating to that reality from your true center, which is God alone, service to the divine and all, just what we're thinking of, you see? And you're not changing what it is. You're not pretending it's any worse than it is. And you're not pretending it's any less beautiful than it is. You know, my daughter just had a baby and it's my first grandchild. I mean, I'm just anticipating. It's a beautiful, wonderful child. I can see that it's a living saint that's come to our family, you know? You can be totally just delighted, but you don't suddenly live where the center of my life is this grandchild, and now everything revolves around this grandchild, because if you're out on a limb like that, and the limb breaks off, you fall. If you're standing in the center and the limb breaks off, you may have a broken limb, but nonetheless, you're still just standing right where you were standing. Emotion is making the center of your reality the branches. Feeling is standing in the trunk of the tree, but still experiencing the phenomenon, which is as big as the branches stand. Okay, does that work?
Yeah, and actually you, without even trying, answered a question I kind of had about, you know, the spiritual path and marriage and how, you know, Yogananda talks about, you know, it's condoned when it does bring you closer to God, but a lot of people went off the path because of that.
Right.
And in that story, I just realized in my head that makes so much more sense, because that means that these people were making that relationship or that other person the center of their happiness.
That's exactly right.
And I can't say I haven't been guilty of that before, making someone else
right in
charge of my emotions, so to speak.
Exactly. But you see, at the same time, if you are the whole tree,
yeah,
you have to keep that branch alive.
Yeah.
Because it's your responsibility to keep that branch alive. But you do it from here instead of from there. Yeah, it's everything is a lot more stable. Okay, very good. Anything else? Well, that was fun. Okay. Thank you all.